The Bible says that you got a book as well, Demaratus.
Yes.
I mean, I haven't seen it. Can you tell me something about it?
It'll be off the press in 2 weeks in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 360-some pages. And I'm publishing it myself.
Oh.
And the first printing is 5,000 copies.
No. Can you tell me something about it? What is it? About, I mean, you cannot judge by the album, obviously. I mean, the story has to be more cohesive, if I may say.
So. There is, the book is written, it's a book for people who hate to read, and it's written in the style of a screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
So that each situation is described in terms of what a camera would see, what the physical action is, what the people say, and what they do. And so it takes you very quickly through complicated situations where if you'd written it as a normal book, it would be like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fiction book, and it's very funny.
Has it got anything to do with the album? I mean, can the album be used as a soundtrack to it? Or?
Well, the way it works is the book, you know what the unified field theory is, you know?
Probably not.
Well, in physics, they have this thing that they've been looking for. It's the unified field theory that explains the interrelationship between how gravity works, you know, atomic energy, and all this stuff. You know, they're looking for one equation that explains it all and makes it work, because right now there's contradictions. And let's just say that the book is like a unified field theory that will hold together Billy the Mountain, Gregory Peckley, Joe's Garage, Demarest, Thin Fish, all these different stories that shows you how they work together to make one long, really complicated story. And the Demarest album is only one part of this major release that is coming out here at the end of this year. There are three other albums that are released at approximately the same time. The Boulez album, the Francesco album, and the Thin Fish album. And the book relates. The Boulez album is not related to it, but all the rest of the stuff is related.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you read the book and listen to those three, plus knowing from the past, Joe's Garage, Billy the Mountain, Gregory Peckley, then it would make an awful lot of sense to you. But other than that, it's very hard to describe.
The way you describe it, it comes as a summation or culmination of what you've been working for the past 20 years, let's say.
Well, no, it doesn't really work like that. But for people, especially in Europe, when they want to know more about what the lyrics mean, if they can read English, the book will help them.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can't, it'll confuse them very much.
Any possibility for the book being issued in this country?
We have to find out. Since I'm paying to have it printed myself, I have to see whether or not I can sell enough of them in the United States. I haven't even spoken to any publishers in the world. I took it to publishers in the United States and they were afraid of it, so I said, forget it, I'll just print it myself and sell it mail order.
But it's obvious, I mean, well, what's published nowadays, that anything serious, you know, doesn't really... It's only a dross being printed nowadays, as far as I can get it.
Yes, but when you talk to a U.S. publisher, they are more concerned that it look like a book. And this doesn't look like a book. It looks like a screenplay. And so they have taken the position that people won't read it because it doesn't say the leaves fell off the tree and it's 5 o'clock and it's all in paragraphs like that. But I personally don't like to read. And I've said in other interviews, for me, reading is about as much fun as standing in line at the passport window in a French airport.
It's that exciting.
So it's designed basically for people who would enjoy the albums rather than for a literary audience.
Mm-hmm. Now saying that the book, which is in a book form obviously, is written like a screenplay, and the music you've been making for the past 20 years...
It's also written like a screenplay.
Yeah. You obviously have a certain disregard for what is considered a proper album. You know what I mean? one style, each song are nicely defined. I mean, let's take Them or Us.
Mm-hmm.
It's there are different pieces, which I mean by the today's industry standard, is way out.
Mm-hmm. So.
So, well, my question is, how have you managed to survive all these years in such a bitchy industry?
It's not even a matter of surviving in it, because I refuse to be stopped. You know, just because somebody, there's a big audience that wants albums that have all the same songs on them. And there's a number of other artists who do that. So they're never going to run out of material. They'll always have what they like. But the people who like what I do like variety. And they enjoy that experience of having the contrast between a song in one style with one kind of a sound followed by something completely different. To them, that's a refreshing experience. And that's the way I like to hear music. I like things next to each other that at first seem incongruous, but then when you step back and look at the whole thing, you see that it fits together properly.
Excuse me, do you mind if I take a couple of shots while you talk?
So in this context of the previous question, what does a success mean to you?
Success to me is if I have a musical or let's say any kind of artistic concept, and I start out to execute it, if it is executed to 100% of the specifications of what I imagined when the idea first came up, that's success.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing that really matters to me, because if I don't enjoy listening to it myself when it's all done, why did I bother to do it? Because there are other things that I can do to make more money than this. This is a high overhead business. But I happen to like what I'm doing, so to me success is if you get close to 100%.
Another thing that Bach states is that your interest lies more within the serious music.
No. Let me explain to you about serious music. What most people regard as serious music is not really that serious at all. See, there's been a lot of propaganda about classical music since it was first invented. Let's examine the history of classical music briefly, and then you'll see what I'm talking about. When all the music that people regard as great masterpieces today were written for the amusement of kings, churches, or dictators. That's who was paying the rent. If the man who wrote the music happened to be working in a style that was appealing to the person who was paying for it at that time, he had a hit. He had a job, and he stayed alive. If he didn't, that's right. He could lose his fingers, he could lose his head, he could be exiled, or he'd starve to death. There was very little in between. All you have to do is look at a book called Grove's Dictionary of Music and Musicians. And you can see that throughout the ages, there have been guys who had hits and guys who didn't have hits. And it's not necessarily connected to the quality of what they wrote. It's connected to how well they pleased the patron that was paying the freight. And it's the same thing today. So all the norms, the acceptable norms of classical music, are really the taste norms of the church, the king, or the dictator that has been paying for it down through the ages. It was not the taste of the people. People never got to decide. So when you say I have more of an interest in serious music, I take my work seriously. But I perceive it as entertainment, and it's entertainment for those people who like that sort of entertainment. I don't write for a king. I don't write for a church. I don't write for a government. I write for my friends. And that's the way the material should be perceived. It's entertainment for them.
So, well,
even if it's written for an orchestra,
mm-hmm.
or it's written for a rock and roll band, it makes no difference. It's the same people who would listen to the music. I have several orchestral albums, okay? Those are not purchased by people who go out and buy the Dvorak New World Symphony. They're bought by rock and roll consumers. A special type of rock and roll consumer.
So in other words, Bach is wrong, because whatever music you make is serious in approach. Regardless to being regarded as rock and roll, or put in a, you know, in a shop's rack, rock and roll, and the other one is serious music.
Yeah.
I see. Well, theater. Yeah, you recently had two plays.
No, I've written them, but they haven't been produced yet.
I see. No, I mean, you see, the bug is not right, so... that's the only thing I had to... I see, so you are expanding into all these areas. I mean, and movies being an old love of yours since you were 16 or something.
I mean, is there a way to stop you? Because you can't... It's hard to expand into movies because it costs so much more money to make a movie than it does to make a record. And I'm self-financed.
But if I'm not joking, you were the one of the first to have an independent label.
That's true.
When did you realize that you can be self-employed in the industry that does not, until that time, did not allow self-employment?
I realized that at the point where that first independent label deal was a result of a lawsuit that was brought against MGM. They were happy to give me an independent deal because we caught them doing something with the books that was not right. So they figured, you know, this stuff will never sell, he'll be out of business in 15 minutes, let him do it. But my arrangement is unique in not only in the fact that I'm self-employed, but that I own all my masters. I own the rights to everything that I do. Most people who make records do not. And I fought for that. And I think that it was worth fighting for.
Yeah, I suppose so. So, can you remember what was the first, and when did you get your first guitar?
First guitar that I played on was my father's guitar.
So what was actually the first guitar you owned? Was it after the movie, the Run Home Slow?
No, the first one that I owned, yes, because prior to that time I rented the guitar. I rented a Telecaster from a music store in Ontario, California, but the first one that I was able to buy was the one after Run Home Slow. It was a DS5 Gibson Switchmaster.
Mm-hmm. And, is the one you use now?
It's a customized Stratocaster. The only thing on this guitar that is Fender is the body. Everything else on it is custom. It's a custom neck, that's custom electronics, custom pickups.
Do you use it in the studio as well as on the site?
I just started using this particular guitar in July. And usually when I go on tour, I take a number of guitars and change them during the show. I've always, the 82 tour, I change a lot. In this tour, I haven't just played this one guitar.
Mm-hmm. Right, and the other part of the same article has got to be your thoughts on some of your contemporaries and your people, if you don't mind. People like Chuck Berry?
Chuck Berry? Well, I used to like Chuck Berry when I was in high school. Songs like Havana Moon and Wee Wee Hours, which were the flip sides of the hits that he had, the more bluesy things. And his main innovation, besides the duck walk choreography, was the multiple string guitar solos. The lines were harmonized because you were playing on two strings at once. There was another guitar player that used to do that named Jimmy Nolan, who I had a lot of respect for.
B.B. King?
I don't like B.B. I saw him on television before I went on this tour, and he's still good.
No, yeah, I've seen it recently and I thought he was amazing. Keith Richard?
I don't know anything about Keith Richard.
Jimmy Hendrix?
I knew Jimmy, and I think that the best thing you can say about Jimmy is there is a person who never should use drugs.
John McLaughlin?
I met John. I think he's a great guitar player, and I think that he's probably done a lot to educate American audiences to some aspects of Eastern music that they wouldn't have come into contact with before. We did a tour with McLaughlin, the old Mahavishnu. Did 11 concerts with him.
Lowell George?
No, there's another guy who shouldn't have used drugs.
Eric Clapton?
I don't know, Eric. I haven't seen him in years and years. There's another guy who shouldn't have used drugs.
Jeff Beck?
One of my favorite guitar players on the planet. I think he's from a melodic standpoint, and just in terms of the conception of what he plays, is fabulous. I like Jeff.
Rory Gallagher?
We worked two jobs with Rory Gallagher on this tour, and he's still playing the blues.
Jimmy Page?
I don't know anything about Jimmy.
Peter Green? Jerry Garcia?
We did one concert with Garcia on this tour, but they were finished playing before I got to this. They were the opening act, and I didn't see any of the set.
Pete Townsend?
I've met Pete, but I don't know what I can say about his guitar playing.
Robert Fripp?
I never heard of Robert Fripp playing.
Richie Blackmore?
I think I've met Richie too. I'm not really familiar with the work of these people, because you have to understand I'm not a pop consumer. Mm-hmm. Listen to a lot of
No, no, I was going to ask you at the end of it. I mean, do you actually listen to the records at all?
Well, what I do is I take cassettes with me on the road, because you know, sometimes you sit in a hotel room and you just want to listen to something.
Or the airport or something, yeah. Okay.
But what I take is not rock and roll. I have Chopin, I have Purcell, mm-hmm. I have Webern, I have Berez, I have Bulgarian music. I don't listen to rock and roll.
No? Carlos Santana?
We worked with Carlos Santana in Cologne in 1980 or 81. And it was a similar situation. We did two shows at the Sport Palace in Cologne. They opened the first show, and we closed it. We opened the second show, and they closed it. So I never heard him play.
So, as you said, you don't listen to the popular music. Music, and I don't expect that you know Eddie Van Halen.
I do know Eddie. He comes over to the house because he hangs out with my son.
Oh, I see. But do you know him as a guitar player?
Oh yeah, he and my son play together. It's fabulous. But there's another guy that shouldn't use drugs.
Presumably you don't know The Edge from your tour.
The Edge?
Stuart Adamson from Big Country. What would be your thoughts on the original guitar player of the Mothers, i.e. yourself?
Well, there's one other guy whose work I know that should be included in that list, who I respect, and that's Alan Goldsworth. This is also from a movie.
No, I was going to ask you, who was your favorite guitar player?
Well, my original favorite guitar player was Johnny Guitar Watson. Mm-hmm. Is it not from a technical standpoint, but from listening to what his notes meant in the context in which they were played, and also Guitar Slim, mm-hmm. who's the first guitar player that I ever heard that had distortion, even during the 50s. And I, in a strange way, I think I probably derived more of my style from his approach to the guitar. From the souls that I heard then.
And so you haven't told me your thoughts on yourself as a guitar player.
Well, I do something really different on the guitar. I don't so much play the guitar as make up stuff. And I'm dealing with the notes that I play during a solo. I can see it as a composition that's happening instantly at the time, but it's, you know, you have 2 minutes to fill up or 9 minutes to fill up or whatever it is. You know, this is, you have a piece of time which is anywhere from 2 to 9 minutes long, and you're going to decorate it with notes. You're going to make a composition in there. The quality of that composition is determined by what you are physically capable of playing at that moment in time, what the rhythm section will allow you to play, and whether or not the keyboard player who's supplying the harmonic climate is going to mess up what you're playing by sticking in his favorite jazz chord right there. These are all the dangers that a person faces when improvising a guitar solo. There's some guitar players who will practice their solos and it will always be perfect and will be the same every night, and I don't do that. When it's time to play, I don't know what I'm going to play until I start doing it. And then an idea will pop up and I'll just develop it in the same way that I would develop an idea on a piece of paper, except that I don't have to wait to hear it. I get to hear it as it's coming out.
And the last question on this section is, what would be the future of guitar, or rather, how do you see the future of guitar in the increasingly synth and keyboard-oriented music?
There will always be a market for people who want to hear guitars squealing and oinking and bending and twanging and making sounds like guitars are supposed to make. And then there is a market of people who are interested in fashion, and they will start to hate all those other old guitar sounds in favor of guitar sounds which are not like guitar sounds. They're merely played in guitar position but sound like synthesizers. There's a market for that that people want to hear. But I don't believe that that will be the ultimate future of the guitar.
And before he takes over completely, I'd like to ask you two questions, which I'm personally interested in. The first is the sometime in the New York City. John Lennon and Yoko Ono. Well, how was it? How did it come about and all that?
The day before the show, a journalist in New York City woke me up, knocked on the door, he's standing there with a paper where he says, "Frank, I'd like to introduce you to John Lennon." You know, waiting for me to gasp and fall on the floor. You know? And I said, "Okay, well, come on in." And we sat around and talked, and you know, I think the first thing he said to me is, "Well, you're not as ugly as I thought you would be." So anyway, I thought he had a pretty good sense of humor. So I invited him to come down and jam with us at the Fillmore East. And we had already booked in a recording truck because we were making the Live at the Fillmore album at that time. And after they had sat in with us, an arrangement was made that we would both have access to the tapes. He wanted to release it, you know, with his mix, and I had the right to release it with my mix. So that's how that one section came out. But the bad part is, there's a song that I wrote called King Kong, which we played that night. And I don't know whether it was Yoko's idea or John's idea, but they changed the name of the song to Jam Rag, gave themselves writing and publishing credit on it, and stuck it on the album and never paid them.
Mm-hmm.
Really, like, obviously not a jam session song. It's got a melody, it's got, you know, bass line, it's, you know, it's obviously an organized song. A little bit disappointed. And I've never released my version of the mixes of that night.
Do you ever intend to?
One day, yeah. Because they would be drastically different. There were things that were edited out of their version, and certain words that were being sung that were removed, you know, because of the editorial slant that they wanted to apply to the material. I have a slightly different viewpoint on it.
And the last question is, you've been promising a 10-volume set of The Suits.
Never of The Suits. No, The Suits don't have 10 volumes worth of material, but what will come out is, now that I own all of the masters for my stuff, the first box that has the first seven
Mother's song.
Yeah, all the early Mother's stuff, plus the mystery disc, which has some Suits material on it.
Mm-hmm.
That is now ready for release in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But the 10 record set that you referred to was the live recordings of the early Mothers of Invention. And I can release that, but I'm not going to until after I've re-released the whole catalog of the basic albums.
Mm-hmm.
That I just got back from this lawsuit, and that's coming out 7 records per year with one box per year for 5 years.
Good guy. I'll listen to them. Thank you very much, Nick.
Okay.
Looking like we usually look, and then they come walking up on stage looking like they usually look, and the audience couldn't believe that they were on stage with us. United States Marines in full dress uniform with the Mothers. And there they were, and people were just sort of quiet, waiting for something to happen. So I gave them the signal, and they lunged for the microphones and started screaming, "Kill, kill, kill." The audience laughed. Then I had them sing their songs. After it was all over, I walked to the microphone, and I said, "Thank you." And then I motioned to Ray, the lead singer, and he walked to the microphone and said, "Thank you." And then I went back to the microphone, and I said, "Thank you." And he said, "Thank you." And we kept doing it until it got very redundant, and we hoped to involve the Marines in this whole redundant unit and expected them to go up and say thank you. I pointed to the first Marine, he walked to the microphone and said, "Eat the apple, stuff the core. Some of us love our mothers more." And there was dead silence in the room. Then we went into some electronic music, and they sat down on the stage. I sent out during intermission for a large doll, a girl doll about that tall. They brought it back, and during one of our hot numbers, I gave them instructions to mutilate the doll, just like they're trained to do back at the camp. And they did it. They just ripped the piss out of this doll. They stomped on it, they mangled it, they messed the eyes up. They really did a good job on it. They trained those suckers, boy.
Yes, it's Frank Zappa and the Mothers in person, inflaming you with their electric instruments and singing outrageous songs about you and all your friends.
There's still tickets for the first concert, and now there's a second concert, Friday, January 23rd. Book now at the usual agencies for $6.80 inclusive.
If you miss this concert, you will forever be an incomplete person.
The Mothers are coming.
Frank Zappa.
Yes.
John Miller, 3X wife, Frank.
How you doing?
Very well. How are you?
Oh, just wonderful. I finished the lobster morning in the restaurant.
Uh-huh. What are the Sydney restaurants like?
Well, I'll say that their flapjacks are atrocious, and their crayfish is quite nice.
Uh-huh. Well, it was winter last time you were out here. Is the climactic conditions having any effect on how you're performing?
Well, let's see. We haven't played a concert in Australia yet. We won't until tomorrow night. The weather in New Zealand was quite a bit different. It was much wetter.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that the temperature being what it was inside of the hall, which was approximately 180 degrees on stage under the lights, it makes for a hot show.
Yeah, the reports out of New Zealand suggest that perhaps you're getting back more to the theater of the stage, Fillmore type thing. Would that be accurate?
I wouldn't say that it's a Fillmore type of a show, no, but it is definitely a show. There's no breaks between the songs. It runs about 2.5 hours, and it's all vocals except for about 3 instrumentals that we do in the show. Everybody sings, and there's quite a bit of cavorting and absurd activity on the stage.
Is this more fulfilling type of performance as far as you're concerned than the...
Well, I enjoy it more because it gives me more of a chance to play the guitar and have a good time.
Right.
And, it's more fun for me.
Are you getting, how much of the drive do you get out of performing? How much of the year do you perform?
Well, we just finished a 2-month tour, and then we played across the Christmas holidays and had approximately 7 days off, and then we started up on another 2-month tour. We'll go through Australia, up through Japan, and then through Europe, winding up in Spain, and then back to the States, where we'll go into the studio again to work on the next album.
Really? That's a pretty hectic sort of schedule.
Oh, it's not bad. I remember the days when we used to spend 7 or 8 months out of the year on the road, and then we managed to cut it down to about 5 or 6 now.
Well, we certainly look forward to your Melbourne concerts, which are here next Thursday and Friday nights.
All right, then.
Frank, thanks very much for talking to us.
If people ever asked you how you got in contact with music?
No.
No. So I'm not going to ask you?
Well, I mean, the first kind of music I remember hearing was Arab music. I heard it when I was a kid, but I didn't start playing a musical instrument until I was 12. I started playing drums then. And I started writing when I was 14, and I started playing the guitar when I was 18. And in between, I was listening to rhythm and blues records and recordings of early 20th century classical music.
How do you look back on the early period of the Mothers of Invention?
I didn't care for it that much. I mean, I didn't enjoy it that much when I was doing it, and I certainly don't look back on it fondly.
How different are things now concerned to the things you did some 20 years ago?
In what regard?
Well, in touring.
Well, this is a much larger, much more complicated touring package. There's 43 people on the road, 3 buses, 5 trucks. And it's like moving an army around.
Mm-hmm.
It's because the band is so big and the equipment is so extensive. This is much larger than what we used to do when we first came over here.
Which gives you a financial problem as well.
Well,
I suppose.
Yes. if you are touring with that many people, I mean, nobody does this for fun, and they all get a paycheck. And because they're all experts at what they do, they get good paychecks. So I don't know right now whether or not I will make a profit by the end of the European tour, June 9th. I hope that I do, because if I do, then I can reinvest it in rehearsals and be able to do it again. But if I don't, then I don't know.
You're 47 years old now?
Mm-hmm.
And still you're touring. Aren't you fed up with touring?
Well, I like playing, but I don't enjoy traveling. So I don't see any other way to play unless I travel. So when I get on an airplane or go through an airport, I just kind of turn my brain off and try and pretend it's not happening.
What's your favorite instrument?
To write for?
Yeah, to write for or to play on?
Well, I like the bassoon as an instrument to write for, but I don't play one. Uh-huh. And to play on, I like the guitar.
What is so special about the guitar? I'm not a guitar player. I learned a bit how to play the drums, and I used to play the flute, but that's all.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting about playing the guitar?
Well, because of the way that it works and because of the way the human hand is constructed, you might say that the guitar is the only instrument that human beings never have mastered yet, because there is no one correct way to play it. There have been several people who have mastered the piano through history.
Mm-hmm.
But the individual styles or things that you can do with six strings on a guitar, the mathematical possibilities are pretty large. And so it's an instrument full of opportunities.
Who's your guitar hero?
Well, the first guy that I really enjoyed listening to was Johnny Guitar Watson, and also Clarence Gatemouth Brown, and then Wes Montgomery. I would say those are the most important ones for me.
What do they have? What is the strength?
In the case of Johnny Guitar Watson, it would be an attitude. In the case of Clarence Gatemouth Brown, it was a style. And in the case of Wes Montgomery, it was a harmonic approach and his sound.
How do you see your place in rock history? As you now mention Johnny Guitar Watson, who is a statue in rock music, such as Sly Stone is. How do you see your own place in rock history?
I don't think about it.
No? Still after all these years?
No. I'll give you an example of the kind of a guy who worries about his place in history. Ronald Reagan. There's a guy who worries about his place in history.
You're really fed up with Reagan, huh?
Yeah, what a pathetic guy.
And the other guys who are now going for the position of president?
I don't like any of them.
What would America be without a president?
Probably be a mess. Big mess. At least with a president, it's a small mess.
If the American government invited you to be president?
They should be so lucky.
In what way?
Because there's no question that I could do a better job than any of the fuckers that are in there now. There's just no question.
I see you standing on the stage and you're conducting in an almost classical approach.
Well, one of the things that I do when I'm conducting is, because the rhythm of what we're playing is sometimes complicated for the musicians to see cues that tell them when to do things, keeps the band together. If there was no hand cue or no stick to show them where the beat was, then things would be sloppier. That's the reason for doing it.
Mm.
I don't conduct them in the same way that a conductor does a symphony orchestra, because it's a different kind of a thing. but the conducting is necessary to make things work right.
What is the moment, after all, which gives you the most, well, the best feeling?
Well, I had a pretty good time last night at this concert in Sweden because I was introduced to two young musicians who live in a town north of Stockholm called Umeå. One of them was a 17-year-old blind keyboard player, and the other one was a 20-year-old drummer, and they have been practicing, you know, the music that I've written. The keyboard player has been playing it since he was 9. So I met them before the show, and I invited them to play with us during the show. And it was a big surprise for the audience and for the guys in the band, because they came out there and they played unbelievable. Just unbelievable. And that was very worthwhile.
Can we expect a collaboration between your two children and you, Dweezil, Moon, and Frank?
Well, maybe even Dweezil, Moon, and Amit, and me. Dweezil played with us last night in Stockholm. He played two songs with us, and he'll probably play again when we're in Munich. I think we should do something together. I wrote a new song yesterday called Dragon Master, which is a thrash metal, kind of Metallica kind of a song, and I think that when we finally record it, I'll have Dweezil playing the guitar on it.
He's a good guitar player?
Fantastic, yeah. He's an excellent guitar player. Message sounds like, you know, you're going to make somebody take medicine. I think that if you do music, there should be some reason that goes beyond just making a piece of product. There should be a reason for doing the song. And for all of my songs, no matter what style they're in, there's a reason why they exist. They're either about something or they are experimenting in styles that haven't been attempted before.
How far can experiment go to you? What does the word experiment do to you in a musical way?
Well, let's take for example a song like the Jazz Discharge Party Hats. Here's a song that was recorded live. It was completely unrehearsed. I made up all the words and the melody line at the time that it was being performed. And the band accompaniment that goes along with it was completely improvised. Nobody knew what I was going to say. Nobody knew what I was going to do. After the live recording was complete, Steve Vai wrote out all the notes that I had sung in this piece. And then in the studio, he doubled the vocal part with the guitar. So the experiment there was to try and imagine, you know, George Benson's guitar style where he plays along with what he sings, but it's always nice, pretty notes. So imagine if you were to do that same George Benson type of style, but with those kind of notes. I don't think anybody had ever tried that before, and that's an experiment.
Is improvisation a thing which is almost absent in nowadays pop music?
Most groups don't improvise because they don't want to take the chance. Anytime you deviate from what you've rehearsed or what you already know, you are taking a chance. Because for an entire band to improvise, that means that everybody in the band has to rely on everybody else in the band to use their imagination in a creative way and in a productive way, so that when the song is over, you did something that was worth listening to, rather than just wandering around in the wilderness making a mess out of things. So most groups don't want to take that chance because they're too concerned about their image.
In his 15-year career in rock, Frank Zappa has been known as eccentric and cynical. Since his earliest days with his first rock group, the Mothers of Invention, Zappa has been making parody records a regular part of his repertoire. His latest satire featuring his daughter Moon is Valley Girl and is one of his most popular singles to date. Zappa is also known for his sophisticated mixtures of avant-garde rock music with jazz and rhythm and blues. But what many Frank Zappa fans may not realize is that he's an experienced composer of orchestral and ensemble music. Though he wanted to attend Juilliard at one time, Frank has never had any formal musical training. He first started playing the snare drum and later the guitar. We asked Frank how he became involved with composing classical music.
I originally started off as a graphic artist, and I used to draw pictures when I was a kid, and I used to like the way that music looked on paper. One day I said, well, anybody can do that, so I got some music paper and started drawing music, and then I went looking for musicians and handed it to them to see whether they could play it. So I didn't write any rock and roll music until I was about 22 or 23 years old, and I'd written all these scores, and I kept sending them out, waiting for somebody to play them, and then nobody would do anything with it, so I figured if I was going to get any of my music played, I would have to put my own band together and teach it to them. But unfortunately, there's no money to put an orchestra together, so you get a combo together, and you have to write for the medium that's at your disposal.
So Frank assembled his own musicians to perform original compositions. Some examples of these performances that have been recorded are Able Aviation and Art, Pedro's Dowry, and most of the songs on the 200 Motels album. Now we'll hear part of revised music for guitar and low-budget orchestra from the Zappa album Studio 10. Frank talked about some differences between composing classical music and rock.
When you're writing it, you get to hear it all in your head as a perfect performance, which is the only time in life where you will hear it as a perfect performance. In rock, you have a much better chance to get a perfect performance on record or in a live concert than you do writing something for an orchestra, mainly because of the inefficiency of human performers.
Frank reports that orchestras including the Detroit Symphony, the Polish Radio Orchestra, the Buffalo Philharmonic, and the National Ballet of Mexico Orchestra have expressed interest in his compositions, though no deals have been confirmed at this time. He also tells us conductor-composer Pierre Boulez commissioned him to write a score for a 40-piece orchestra. We asked Frank if any of his most recent compositions are under consideration by major orchestras.
There was only one concert with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and all of the new music that I've written has been presented to them and rejected by them because they figure it would be too expensive to rehearse it. The pieces are very difficult. But we just made a deal with the Berlin Festival to have a performance there of all my recent orchestra music.
Frank told us that his favorite composers are Edgar Varese, Anton Webern, and Igor Stravinsky. Now, we'll hear The Soldier's March, The Devil's Dance, and The Triumphant March of the Devil from L'Histoire du Soldat by Stravinsky.
Dette var Frank Zappa med låten Trouble Every Day fra hans første LP Freak Out fra 1966. Sitter her i studio sammen med Kjell Oversand, amanuensis ved Musikkvitenskapelig institutt ved Universitetet i Trondheim. Kjell, du har hatt forelesninger og seminar om Frank Zappa på universitetet, og må vel denne som Zappa kjenner. Kan du slå ned i utgangspunktet fortelle hvem Frank Zappa egentlig er?
Ja, Frank Zappa er ikke lett å presentere med få ord. For de som har fulgt med han i alle år, så er han sikkert en kreativ, såvel som intelligent komponist av alt fra parodier på popmusikk til såkalt seriøs orkestermusikk, filmmusikk, balletter og så videre. For andre er han kanskje en virtuos gitarist, mens kanskje de som kjenner minst til han, er han, for dem er han sikkert bare en langhåret, sprø hippie som spiller gitar og synger stygge sanger.
Hva er målet med å presentere Zappa i undervisningen?
Jeg har laget forelesninger over Zappas musikk, fordi jeg synes han er spesielt interessant, som en som overskrider båstenkninger innen samtidsmusikken. Zappa er blant de som har holdt på lengst og vært mest aktiv innen rockmusikkområdet også. Han startet for øvrig som komponist i 14-årsalderen, inspirert av modernister som Edgar Varese og Igor Stravinsky, Først i 20-årsalderen begynte han å skrive rockmusikk.
Zappa har alltid vært kritisk til det bestående, det vil si det han mener har grodd fast i en form, som for eksempel hippiekulturen og den amerikanske måten å leve på. I låta Plastic People fremstiller Zappa menneskene som plastikdukker. Hans tekster er ikke akkurat av hjertesmertetypen, og det kommer tydelig fram her. Og ideene til tekstene, de henter han fra ting som hender ham eller venner av ham, eller det kan være noe han leser i aviser eller ser på TV.
A lot of them come from things that have either happened to me or happened to guys in the band or things that I see on television or things that I read in the newspaper. The Illinois Enema Bandit, which is one of our more famous songs, is a true story, and it's something that I heard on a car radio almost 12 years ago about a man who was doing that. And other things like Pick Me, I'm Clean on the Tinseltown Rebellion album is a true story about a girl that followed some members of the band around during our tour in France in 1980. And things like the Fillmore East album with the groupie story, the girl who wouldn't fuck the guy unless he sang his hit single, and she wanted him to sing The Bullet too. This is all real. These things have actually happened.
Som dere hørte, det er nok av eksempler på låter med historier fra det virkelige liv. Dette her var tekstene. Musikken Zappa lager, den er sammensatt av mye rart. Han kan koble typiske popfraser med Stravinsky-lignende seriøs musikk, og midt oppi det hele legge en litt snorking eller annen merkelig lyd. Det skjer stadig noe overraskende. Vi skal servere et par parodier Zappa har laget. Først en på Bob Dylan, og så Lonesome Cowboy Bert. Det er selvsagt en country-parodi.
Bell, det må jo være retninger innen populærmusikken som Zappa tar alvorlig.
Ja, det er jo avhengig av hva vi mener med å ta alvorlig her da. Men i alle fall så har Frank Zappa stadig uttrykt sin beundring og musikalske gjeld til svart rytme og blues. Særlig representert ved gitarrister som Johnny Watson og Guitar Slim for eksempel.
Og her et eksempel hvor denne innflytelsen er svært så tydelig. Den gir også et godt bilde av Zappa som gitarrist. Låta heter Willie the Pimp og er fra LP'en Hot Rats. Den er utgitt i 1969, og det er Captain Beefheart. Så et litt eksempel på seriøs musikk som Zappa har lavet. Igor's Boogie.
As far as I'm concerned, I have no connection to the serious music community. If I do music for orchestra, the people who come to the concert are the same ones who come to the rock show. It's not suddenly everybody's all dressed up and they have white hair and bow ties and they're very distinguished and the women are wearing jewels. It's the same people who would go and see a rock concert.
It's a good thing.
Yeah, it is a good thing because what I do is not for the entertainment of those people with the bow ties and the white hair. They wouldn't enjoy it.
Jeg skriver både seriøs musikk og rock, sier Zappa, men han har ikke noe direkte forbindelse med de som driver med seriøs musikk. Det er de samme menneskene som kommer til konsertene mine, uansett hva jeg framfører. Og han skriver ikke musikk for mennesker i kjole og hvitt. De vil ikke like det jeg gjør, sier Zappa. Og før vi forlater ham, her kommer han med et plateønske.
Well, you know what I would like to have you do, since you probably won't have access to any of the cuts from the new album that we have coming out on EMI, is play some stuff from the Man from Utopia album, because I think there are good cuts on there, some very strange things that never got on the air. Like The Dangerous Kitchen, and The Radio Is Broken, and a song about unions called Stick Together.
Every time they do. You know we gotta stick together.
We gotta stick together.
You know we gotta stick together.
We gotta stick together.
You know we gotta stick together.
We gotta stick together.
You know we gotta stick together.
We gotta stick together.
Once upon a time, the idea was good. If only they'd have done what they said they would. It ain't no better, it's making it worse. The labor movement got the mafia curse. You know we gotta stick together. 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 Don't be no fool, don't be no dope. Common sense is your only hope. When the union tells you it's time to strike, tell the motherfucker to take a hike. You know we gotta stick together. 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 You know we gotta stick together.
Frank Zappa med Stick Together fra LP:n Man from Utopia.
Jag kallar honom för rockens stora original. Han lyssnar faktiskt bara på klassisk musik privat. Jag träffade honom när han var i Göteborg och det var i början på maj, så det är faktiskt ett tag sedan. Och han är ett riktigt charmtroll, det kan jag tala om. Han skriver otroliga mängder av texter och musik, men han bryr sig inte ett dugg om konsekvenserna. Så här tyckte han om våran lilla pratstund.
Hello, this is Frank Zappa. Welcome to Charlie's Enormous Mouth.
Hello, anybody home? Special delivery.
Oh, no.
Registered mail, you're gonna have to sign for this, buddy.
Oh, no.
Come on, I know you're in there.
Oh, no. I don't wanna get drafted, I don't wanna go. I don't wanna get drafted.
Hello, Frank Zappa, hi.
Okay, how you doing, Charlie?
I would like to know what happened to Bobby Brown. Did he get drafted?
No, Bobby Brown will never get drafted.
You're absolutely sure of that?
Positive. He's in radio promo now. Uh-huh. You can't draft those people. Nobody wants them in the army.
Two hit songs in Sweden, that's really great. I mean, that's really saying something. You've been very successful here. Why do you think you've been so successful just in Sweden?
It was an accident.
Why?
Probably because somebody started playing Bobby Brown in a disco, because it wasn't from Airplay. And that's how it got to be successful.
But Bobby Brown didn't get anywhere in the States, is that right?
No, they can't play that on the radio.
Why do you keep writing lyrics that are so sort of, the people in the States don't seem to appreciate them that much. How's that?
That's their problem. You know, I do what I have to do. If they like it, fine. If they don't, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. But you think it's important that people should listen to that kind of lyric?
Sure. I think that I do what I do for the people who like that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And people who like other music should listen to other music.
Mm-hmm. How about music and lyrics? Which is the most important, the lyrics or the music?
Depends. In a song like Bobby Brown, I think the lyrics are more important than the music.
Mm-hmm.
In a song like Inca Roads, I think the music is more important than the lyrics.
Hey there, people, I'm Bobby Brown.
They say I'm the cutest boy in town. My car is fast, my teeth are shiny. I tell all the girls they can kiss my hiney. Here I am at a famous school. I'm dressing sharp and I'm acting cool. I got a cheerleader here, wants to help with my paper. Let her do all the work and maybe later I'll read her. Oh God, I am the American dream. I do not think I'm too extreme. And I'm a handsome son of a bitch. I'm gonna get a good job and be real rich.
So if you listen to some other artists, what do you listen to first?
I usually don't listen to other artists. I'm not a rock and roll consumer. I listen to classical music.
How do you manage to make so many albums every year? I mean, you just make such a lot of music and it's all of good quality. How do you manage to produce so many albums?
Just because I'm a wonderful guy. Just go in there and start doing it. And I don't know. That's what I like to do.
You've made about 40 albums, is that right?
No, about 35.
35, well, you're not far off. There'll be another five next year, and then you'll be up to it, right? Where did you learn to play the guitar?
Where?
Yeah, and how?
I started off playing the drums, and my little brother got a guitar at an auction for $1.50. Very cheap, horrible guitar. And I started playing around with it when I was about 18.
And your favorite Frank Zappa song, what's that?
My favorite song? I don't have a favorite song.
Anyone that you like especially for some reason?
Right now I like No Not Now. That's my favorite one on this album.
Something about your latest new, very new album, Frank.
It's called Ship Arriving Too Late to Save a Drowning Witch. There it is.
Anything special about it? Why did you think of that very funny and original title?
That's the name of the cartoon that's on the front, which was drawn in 1953 by this guy. I saw it in a book and I always liked the picture, and recently I tried to find the guy who did it and found out that he lived about 10 miles away from me and bought permission to use the picture on the cover of the album. So there it is.
Does it symbolize anything special in the contents of the lyrics or something?
I think that it sort of sums up the world situation today.
And that's what your album is about, the world situation?
No, it's not about the world situation at all. It's for entertainment purposes only.
Det var Charlotte von Proschwitz som hade träffat Frank Zappa när han var på sitt Göteborgsbesök för inte.
Halloween guy.
The Zappa. Listen, that film is called Dublin.
And Dublin Special.
You were saying that you made it to be shown not in movie theaters.
Yes.
But in nightclubs. That's kind of an interesting new medium.
Well, there are a lot of clubs these days that are equipped with large screen video projection, and some places have a lot of little TVs all over the place and a big loud PA system, and this is ideal for that.
This does not seem like the kind of picture you'd like over your shoulder as you're trying to get the latest step down at the local disco, though, Frank.
Yeah, that's true. But then again, there are plenty of other people performing that function. I try and take care of the people on the fringe of... they have needs that need to be met, and I try to accommodate their desires and entertainment.
So dirty work what someone has to do.
That's it.
Halloween, we only have about 30 seconds left, so I'm going to ask you this question. Maybe we won't get to answer it until after the break, but you really have a love relationship with this holiday. You fly all the way from L.A. to New York every Halloween for the past 10 years to celebrate and have fun, perform, and do something. And I want to know what, like, 1982 Halloween means to you and all the sad, crazy things that are going on this year with your favorite holiday.
Before or after the break?
It looks like after the break. We'll be right back with that answer. In a moment.
At age 14, Frank Zappa started writing classical music. In 1984, conductor Pierre Boulez will perform one of Zappa's works.
Broadcasting here, but the subject matter is in a very narrow range. You get to see the same kinds of things over and over again.
This is the man who knows breakfast best.
Cinnamon Life cereal. Unless they're weird, your kids will eat.
Introducing the only shredded wheat with no preservatives.
Delicious! Frosted Lucky Charms!
Frosted Lucky Charms!
Delicious!
From the man who knows breakfast best.
Do you think that TV in the United States is a mirror of how people want to be or become, or a mirror of how the government and the companies want the Americans to be?
Both. Because the programming that is brought to the American people is very scientifically manufactured. They do research on it to make sure that enough people will watch it, that the sponsors who buy the time are going to get a result for their dollar investment. So a lot of the stuff that goes on the air has already been researched, and it has been ascertained that there are enough stupid people in this country who want to watch it.
There has been an arrest tonight in the murder of a 24-year-old art student near Brooklyn's Pratt Institute.
Davis is charged with trying to kill 9 police officers in the Bronx in 1986. 23-year-old Carter Cooper killed himself last week, jumping off the terrace of his mother's Manhattan penthouse. She tried and failed to save him.
The co-pilot was killed, and the pilot, Curtis Walters, remains in critical condition tonight, fighting for his life.
Most of the reports dealing with news in other parts of the world are stupid here, and it goes back to a slogan from CBS News. If it don't bleed, it don't lead. In other words, if the top story of the hour doesn't have some death involved in it in some way, it's not going to be good news entertainment, and so therefore doesn't get good coverage. And the people who run the news in the United States are always looking for the most spectacular bloody event someplace in the world to keep their news ratings up, because if there's no blood, the audience will turn to something else. And what happens in a week when there's not much blood?
Somebody got killed.
To try and describe how bad television could be in the United States, I suggested that they create something called the Mortuary Channel, which would be a specialized broadcast channel, 24 hours a day, that featured as entertainment people being embalmed and made up for burial. And I believe that the U.S. audience is twisted enough that if such a thing were to go on the air, not only would it make money, but people would watch it all the time. Furthermore, you'd have some people writing into their will that they would not want to be buried until they had at least been on television when they were dead.
What kind of commercial do you think would fit in that program?
How about commercials for mortuaries? How about commercials for places that sell burial plots? or the Neptune Society, which actually advertises on regular television that you can have a burial at sea, you can be cremated and your ashes can be sprinkled at sea.
Or just flushed up through the toilet?
I think so.
That's the
there may be a law against that.
Even your faith. So it's learning how, then, to release your faith in what God said and God's word. And then that begins to produce miracles. I have put these truths on how to release your faith in God's word in this little book entitled God's Miracle Plan for Man.
The electronic church is a big racket in the United States that take millions and millions, well, maybe the figure is in the billions, from the people sitting at home who want to have a religious experience without leaving their armchair. And the way it works is, one of the rackets is something called prosperity theology. There are Jim and Tammy Baker were involved in that. There's another guy named Robert Tilton who's still on the air who preaches this kind of stuff. The idea is that all of your financial problems will be cured by Jesus. But the way he will cure them is you have to prove to Jesus that you trust him. And the way you prove to Jesus that you trust him is to send a large amount of money, more than you can really afford in your life. It has to be a painful offering. You send this painful offering to the preacher on television, and by doing so, he tells you that that proves to Jesus that you love him, you believe him, and you trust him, and then, and only then, he will solve all the rest of your financial worries. So people actually do this. They actually send this money, they charge it on their credit card or whatever. Because, and the people who would do this have a similar mindset to people who would buy a lottery ticket. They're taking a gamble. If it works, Jesus will take care of me, and if it doesn't, well, at least I tried.
It's your faith that causes you to draw near to me, for my hands are open. If you'll draw nigh to me this day through your faith.
Promotion. These evangelists, the people from the video church, made a deal with the Republican Party in 1979 that they reinvested some of the money that they took from these people who would send it in. This money was given directly to the Republican Party to help them finance the political campaigns of those candidates who would agree to support the policies of these churches. So they had a partnership going. But they're still trying. They still want to have a ban on abortion. They still want to have prayer in school. They still want to have all homosexuality declared as sinful and against the law. And, you know, the same thing that they've been ranting about since Reagan got in. I had a lot of problems with it, and which is basically why I don't have a television show right now. I tried to, for almost a year, tried to put together some kind of a show that would be on the air here and in Europe. Couldn't do it. In one instance where I had a chance to get some access to some time, at the last minute the people who ran the station pulled out because they also happened to have Jimmy Swaggart on their station. And I told them bluntly when I approached them about doing the show that one of the things that I was going to have on my show was material that would ridicule television evangelists. Well, these people, this was Channel 18 here in Los Angeles, the people who ran the station decided that they really shouldn't put my show on the air, because if my show went on, then they might lose Swaggart's account, and Swaggart was paying them a lot of money for the airtime. I think the only way that I could do it would be to make a deal with a European channel and eventually have the show brought back into the United States.
Try my Mint Fresh Polident. It's got a minty mouthwash ingredient, so it freshens up dentures as it cleans tough stains. Try Super Strength Polident Green, the mouth freshening clean. Ah.
There's an illusion in the United States that we have free press, and it is purely an illusion. Excuse me. Because the censorship that takes place here doesn't just come from the government, it comes from It is a result of the editorial viewpoint of the people who own the individual broadcast licenses and the individual newspapers and magazines. So none of these people are liberal. Everybody, I would say 90% of the people who own media are of an extreme right-wing persuasion. In fact, one of the things that these right-wing broadcasters have done is to create a smokescreen. A few years ago, they started this campaign that worked like this. They had people from right-wing organizations go on television and complain that the media had a liberal bias, and then spent a year or more having debates and arguments between these people who would talk about whether or not, in fact, the media was too liberal. And it never was liberal. It was always right-wing. But by bringing these people from the right wing onto television to challenge the liberality of broadcasting, they created a situation where they could claim that in order to have more fairness in their broadcasting, they had to inject more right wing element into the broadcasting. Think about that. Nice trick. And it's still going on today. I mean, they've created the myth that American broadcasting and American media, it has a liberal bias. It never has had. It couldn't have, because the people who own it are in no way liberal. The thing is that there's an attitude in the United States that it's an unspoken attitude that if, as an American, you become too interested in things going on in other countries, then maybe you're not really a good American. You know, good Americans in the right-wing sense of the word are people who absolutely don't care about what happens anyplace else in the world, and they're only interested in their own economic situation and their own stuff right here. And the FBI recently asked librarians in the United States to keep track of people who checked out certain books out of the library.
Really?
Yeah, like How to Build an Atomic Bomb, or books on communism, or things like that. They actually wanted U.S. librarians to function as spies in the library to report citizens who would check out books on certain topics, and the librarians refused. That doesn't mean that the FBI won't stop trying to find out what kind of people check certain books out of the libraries. But think about that. Do you have that in your country?
No, we in the Soviet.
I think that would be ideal. But one of the reasons why there are certain people who are worried about satellite technique is the easier it is for a person in one country to look in on the lifestyle of a person in another country, the more it tends to create a demand for goods and services that might not be available in one country. For example, if everybody in the Soviet Union could watch as much American television as they wanted, I think that the Soviet government would have some problems, because I believe that inside Russia there are a number of people who are just as stupid as the Americans and who want to buy those potato chips and the rest of that stuff and live that kind of a life. And when they see people consuming it, they're going to want it. It'll drive them wild. It's not an easy solution to the problem of making Americans smart. There's the mechanical problem, and then there's the built-in psychological problem. Americans don't want to be smart. It's embarrassing for them to admit they're smart. In fact, I'm sure you've noticed that Americans do everything they can to pretend to be stupid because they think that they're more likable when they're stupid.
My brother just did something very...
That's not going to change until the educational system is improved in this country. One of the reasons why your premise doesn't work is even if a guy has $400 or $500 and he wants to buy an hour on a satellite, he has to pay that $400 or $500 to a right-wing guy with a certain point of view. And that right-wing guy doesn't care about that $400 or $500. He's more concerned with making sure that the airwaves are ideologically pure. So, if the thing that you want to broadcast has a certain political slant to it, it's not going to go on the air.
Could he actually stop that?
Oh, sure. He doesn't have to sell you the time.
In this country, there are 250 million willing consumers, people dumb enough to buy just about anything from any country. Anything. They're born to buy. The people in this country are bred to purchase things. That's what the educational system turns out. Consumers. So, if any country were to attack the United States, I think that, first of all, the Japanese would come and fight on our behalf to keep an attack from coming in, because they don't want to lose 250 million consumers. And we would be stupid to shoot anything over into the Soviet Union, because that is a whole country full of people willing to pay $100 for a pair of Levi's. So that, you can't get that every day. And it is the desire to do commerce that is going to keep the world from blowing up. Ultimately, it may be the businessmen of the world who keep the place from being destroyed.